Welcome to this episode of Attorneys Are Human Too. Episode 14, Exiting the Matrix with Jerome Myers. I am your host, Steve Wallace. We're joined by our co-host, Selena Music. We're both at the Wallace Law Group, and let's get right to it. We have a true treat today. We have Jerome Myers, who has so many accolades, it's almost impossible for me to list them all. Who Jerome was when he was a child growing up?
The kid that stayed outside till the streetlights came on, because that was as long as I could stay out. We'd go out at the top of the day, and I wouldn't come back unless I was hungry and I couldn't eat at one of my friends' houses. I didn't have any brothers or sisters, so I went and adopted brothers and sisters through friends in the neighborhood. But, you know, super active in sports, really enjoyed school, took pride in being intelligent. I thought for some reason that was cool when a lot of people in my neighborhood didn't, and really driven to excel. I wanted to make mom and dad proud, for lack of sounding cliche.
Not at all. I'm an only child also, and both of us turned out normal, or it's normal, so to speak. Okay, great. So you have a pretty unique resume. You have a pretty distinguished athletic career, as well as one thing that's pretty interesting. If you could just tell us, you know, how you came about to select your university.
Oh, man. So for those of you who don't know, I'm with the North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University. And there's this thing about that school called GEHO. And it's the greatest homecoming on earth. And it's a historically black college and university. And they call it like a family reunion, where people from all over the country, people who didn't even go to school, and we're not probably playing that school during the actual homecoming event, come to hang out. And I mean, there's probably 20 to 30,000 people that come to the university, and the student population is right at 12,000 now. And they've grown over the past 5 or 6 years. When I was there, it was less than 10,000. But I got that opportunity to go do that when I was in middle school, back to friends. So I went to visit one of my friend's sisters for homecoming on one of those weekends. And I got to experience the band, the football, all the people, all of these folks. And I don't know if any of your listeners watched A Different World when it was on TV. But
I love that show.
It was a different world. You had all of these people for me that looked like me who were off getting these degrees. And then you see the fruits of the labor, because, you know, it's primarily known as engineering school. And so those folks were going off and getting pretty well paying jobs. And then you see the luxury cars, you see the nice clothes. And it's like, oh, I thought only drug dealers get this stuff, and preachers. Like, that was my experience, that those were the people who got nice things. But the folks who went to work every day and worked really hard kind of ended up with the stuff that was pretty drab and boring. And so for me, it was like, oh, so I can do that, and I don't have to participate in illegal activities.
So let's take a little step back. So you went to school, you went on a football scholarship to go to school?
No, I actually had two academic full rides.
That's excellent. But you did play football in school, right?
Did. And so
to manage that, that's something, because I know engineering, you know, I have a law degree, and I wouldn't go near engineering because that was way too labor intensive and difficult for me. So I mean, it's miraculous. How are you able to balance both of those? Because they're both like two full time jobs in one.
Yeah. So I think the training, right? If I go back to the story we were talking about, where, you know, I was a kid that stayed outside all day. It was also the kid that like had homework. Then I went to baseball, and I was doing a taekwondo, and I have football. And so I was doing something every season. And so it was just the habit of, hey, this is what you do, right? So you do your homework, you get your sports in, and you eat, and you just kind of do it over and over again. But the long and the short of it, it is difficult. Like, there were 3-hour nights of sleep. You know, I would get up, and especially in the spring, like, we'd have workouts in the morning at 4. We'd get out, we'd go eat breakfast, go to class all day. You got to be out of class by 2, and then your film from 2 to 3, and then 3 to 6. You're practicing, dinner, study hall, and then whatever you don't finish in study hall, you do it in your room at night. And so, you know, bedtime was about midnight, and we did that over and over again And that's how, there is no shortcut. There is no magic bullet. I wish I was that smart where I didn't have to do the stuff, but I had to do the stuff. I went to every class. I didn't skip. There was no laying out. And then the great thing about football that you don't get with like track or basketball or volleyball or baseball is like all the travels at the end of the week. And so for us, you know, I was able to attend a majority of my classes and make sure Friday was my light day so that if we were playing away, I would be able to go travel and not get crushed with the tests or some of the other stuff that came up. But it was just forming that habit and being in a culture of discipline early on that allowed me to continue that through school.
I think it takes a lot of dedication and time. I want to know what troubles you were getting into when you were younger or even in college. I know we all did. I mean, I don't even want to go into my moments, but I want to know what times were you getting in trouble and having, since it was such a disciplined schedule, when did you have time for you?
So, I mean, a lot of this stuff for me, so the short answer on the question is I didn't get in trouble. There just wasn't time for that, right? Everything was just, you move from here to here to here. And if you're serious about the mission of getting a degree, or if you're serious about being a high performing football player, if you're serious about being a pillar in the community and some of the other stuff I was taught in my upbringing, then you couldn't like move this out of the way to go do that. So, and I didn't mention like I had jobs while I was doing this too, because, you know, I was tutoring in study hall for some of the folks because, you know, I was doing fairly well. So they allowed me to be a tutor. I had research projects that I was working on for different professors. And so I was doing everything I could to grow my income while I was in school, because I knew on the back end that I had some goals. And so, you know, I was able to get out of school debt free. And so the trouble thing, I was so focused on things that I guess weren't fun, because I knew that I was on a mission to do something bigger when I was there. And so a lot of people say, well, you missed out on college. And when I think about what the first 5 years after college looked like for me, it was very different from the people who really enjoy college. And so for me, it was well worth it. And I think a lot of people miss this whole, they miss it when they say, oh, well, you need to enjoy it and you need to find yourself and you need to do all these things. Like the stuff that a lot of people were excited about doing in college, like I'd already done it. And, you know, I've never said this like in a public forum, in a place that's recorded, but like, I don't smoke, I don't drink. Like all the, once I turned 16, I had everything I wanted. I had the privilege to do everything I want, which was drive. Mm-hmm. For me, driving was the freedom piece of it all. And so when I could do that, like I didn't really, being 21 was a non-event, right? College parties weren't interesting because I had other stuff that I needed to make sure happened in order for me to get to the place I wanted to get to. And so I ended up not having a ton of friends. And so this is the thing that I think I really messed up with school is, I didn't do a lot from a networking perspective, right? It was, I'm here to take care of business, and then I'm out and going to do the next thing. And I mean, you know, there are things like, you know, student orgs. And I mean, there were so many layers that were stacked on it that, you know, I just didn't have the capacity to do what a lot of people consider to be the college experience. And I'm grateful for that because it gave me so much exposure. Like I got an internship in Africa in between my junior and senior year. Like it was just such a dynamic experience for me that I could have wasted, but I wanted to get all that I could out of it.
Wow, what did you do in Africa? Could you elaborate on that internship? We've never heard that before on the podcast.
Yeah. So I'm a civil engineer by training. And so I was fortunate enough to get the opportunity to work for the Office of Overseas Building Affairs within the State Department. And so we were building a communications building in East Africa, in a country that was in the middle of civil war, which was like terrifying. And the majority of the folks in the culture are fairer skin, or in the community are fairer skin. And so people who have skin like mine were usually captured and taken to like, I don't want to call it a concentration camp, but it was a camp where you were enlisted to fight. And basically, if you didn't fight, then you were killed. And so I wasn't able to go anywhere without like my driver if I wanted to go somewhere in town. And then like I had a couple of guys who were on the team that I was leading. And so like even when we went out, like it was with my like security guy. And so just like getting experiences like that, like I couldn't point to anybody who was doing the same things I was doing and get to do that. But this goes back to like trying to squeeze everything out of it. I got that opportunity because I volunteered to like help put together a Saturday session for the honors program at the university.
Wow. And they
fly in from DC who were interested in one, recruiting high talent, but two, like creating these opportunities where people get the professional development so that when they go to interview or they go to the workplace, they actually have the tools and capabilities they need to be successful there. And so for me, like that was a once in a lifetime event. But I mean, it changed so much more, right? So now that I've been to Africa, I know what it's like to be there, right? And so from that, when I start doing travel and stuff, like instead of going to Europe or some of the more popular tourist destinations, I spend my time in the Caribbean and in Africa because it's not what is made out to be in popular media. And the places that are, like, it gives you appreciation for the privilege that we have in the States. And so
what parts of the Caribbean?
You name it. Like, we've been in Central America, Belize, been to Aruba, Jamaica, like, I mean, Trinidad, like, you name it, I've probably been there or really close to it.
Yeah, Selena's from the Dominican.
I've been there two or three times.
Okay, very cool, very cool. So you must actually know DR very well.
Mm-hmm. I like Punta Cana.
Okay, yeah, that's the touristy. The best part, I think you should check out Samaná. It's a little bit off the beaten trail, but it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we went there at one point. I don't remember.
So how many stamps do you have in your passport?
Lots. I mean, I try to get out of the country 3 times a year at least.
That's fantastic. I think that's great. I mean, I love to travel, so I have a lot of stamps too. But I think that's the best way also to broaden your view on different cultures is by experiencing them and being there. I was born and raised in New York. So for a very long time, I didn't really know what it was to be Dominican. I knew my parents were from there, and luckily they taught my brother, my sister, and myself how to read and write in Spanish and speak Spanish fluently, but we'd never been there. Like, I had never been there for, you know, a long time. It was until I got older that they took me and I went there and experienced a lot, because they were always flying back and forth on business. And I was too little to know any better.
Yeah. I mean, getting back to the roots, whatever they are, and I won't go too far off the path, guys, I promise, but
There's no path to follow. We're having a nice conversation. So
yeah,
that's what we pride ourselves on. Attorneys are human too.
Yeah. So the folks who are descendants of slaves that live in America today, and I mean, they weren't slaves before they were put on the ship and brought here, right? But they were cut off from whatever their heritage is. And there are ways now that you can trace your ancestry, but it's before I knew that I was Nigerian from the Yoruba tribe, like I was always jealous when I would hear people who knew they were from Italy or knew they were from Germany or knew they were Irish being able to say that they knew that, right? Whereas what most people who are descendants of slaves in this country say is they're Black. But what does that actually mean? Because there is no country for Black, right?
Right. So
exactly.
Hearing you say, hey, you know, I was Dominican, but I didn't know, I'd never been, and I had to self-teach myself Spanish and all this stuff, like getting back to your roots, there is something that you find when you connect back to your roots that nobody can give to you. And so going, like when I was in Ghana, I went to the slave castles and I got to the Door of No Return after walking through what were the three different holding chambers that people went in. They basically, every 30 days, you move to a different chamber, and then the boat would come around the 90th day, and you would walk out and get into the boat. But to see how people existed when that type of stuff was happening, in some ways it's terrifying, but for me, it was like super eerie because you could like still feel the heaviness of the place that you were in. And so I bring that all full circle to just say, like, we've got to figure out what our roots are. We've got to stay true to our stated values. And we need to make sure that our actions align. And this goes back to your question, Shalina, about getting in trouble. Like, my stated values were I was going to get out of college. I was going to either start my own company, start my PhD, or go work somewhere where I was getting paid more money than I thought I would ever get paid. And I didn't want anything to impact that. And I remember specifically when I got back, I had two new roommates, and they were people I knew from high school. But I walked in the day that I got back, and I was like, they're sitting on the couch smoking weed. And I'm like, what are y'all doing? Like, and to add insult to injury, like, it was furniture that I bought.
Oh, no.
And it's just like, you guys are idiots. And so, like, literally, like, I moved out that day. Like, I got a U-Haul and moved that day just because I didn't want to be around any mess. Like, I'd worked too hard in order to be in a space where somebody being silly, regardless of how small it is, it's only small until it keeps
happens.
Want.
Yeah, or something happens.
Exactly.
But, yeah, my dad used to always tell us, look at everything from every possibility and every angle. And don't put yourself in that predicament.
So kind of following your path, Jerome, so you finished college and you had a civil engineering degree. And so you have a pretty unique resume where you worked many years in corporate America, and then you just had enough of it. And I've been there too, and we can share that story as well. But I'd love to hear what your path was after you finished college.
Yeah, so I thought I had two paths. It was go do my PhD at the University of South Florida, or go work for a power company in Virginia. And I decided that it was time to start wealth building. So I took the job. And started out as a structural engineer, did that for about a year, maybe 18 months, got a promotion as kind of a team lead for the work that we were doing. And then from there, I moved to an operational role in a distribution business. And so we're responsible for keeping the lights on. It was a 24/7 operation. And I was called the switching supervisor. And so this was the first time where I felt like I really had some real skin in the game. So the guys would come in and they say, hey, here's what's happened. I need you to make sure that there's no electricity on this line while I go do the work. And we have to tell them which devices to move around in order to make the line safe for them to either put up new wire or remove a tree, whatever it was. And then when they got done, re-energize it, and all while keeping as many people's light on as possible. And so that was like a super challenging environment. And this was right in the middle of the recession. And so I was fortunate enough to have a number of different mentors when I was working at the company, and a few of them actually became sponsors. But the guy that was my sponsor for that role, his position got eliminated. And from there, I got stuck. And so I was in a role that I hated for like 30 months. Like the swing shifts, I was working 1 to 11, which, you know, I was in a job where you didn't need a college degree. So it was like all these things. I'm like, this is awful. It's just terrible. I don't ever want to do this again. Who's going to let me out? Who's going to help me? And I remember I applied for 100 jobs at that company, got 10 interviews and got zero offers. And I was like, how did Jerome go from being this high performer, da, 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 to a loser who can't get an engineering job now? And so, you know, eventually I got out of that. A new guy stepped in, started mentoring me, helped me get out of that. And then I got into another job. And the guy said, hey, look, you got 6 months to get a promotion or we're going to cut your bonus. I was like, what do you mean? He said, yeah. And I was like, well, what's the likelihood of that? And he said, well, this lady's been in a job for 2 years. She still hasn't got a promotion. And we're certainly not going to promote you before we promote her. So there you have it. I had recruiters reaching out pretty regularly, had another guy reach out or gal, I can't remember which one it was. And he was like, hey, we got opportunity for you. And so I got this opportunity to build a consulting firm office for a smaller company. It was like 800 people that was headquartered in Pennsylvania. And I moved over to them, started building this office in Richmond. It was crazy. I was driving back and forth from Richmond, Virginia to Pittsburgh every Monday and Friday for like 4 months just to try to make the thing work. And so I did that and I got the opportunity to commit timesheet fraud. Right. And keep adding these things, right? The guy's like, hey, I see you charge an admin budget this week. I say, yeah, my project's over. And the only reason it's relevant is because it was right around this time. It was right around Labor Day. It's like, yeah, my project finished. They're not going to send me a new one until after Labor Day. Well, you don't charge the admin budget. What do you mean? I'm like, I'm done with the project. I don't have the next one yet. I charge the admin budget. He's like, no. He said, don't ever do that again. You'll either take vacation or you figure out how to put your work together so that you don't have any admin charge time. I said, well, I don't own the company, so I'm not doing either one of those, and I'm not going to steal from the client. And he's like, I'm telling you what's going to happen next time. And so I left there, gave back the $10,000 sign-in bonus that I was given. It goes back to like, it's my story. And like, that's when I figured out that I don't do things for money, right? I'm doing things because it's the right thing, whether somebody's watching or not.
Yeah, exactly.
I left there, went to a global consulting firm, got to go back to Africa. That's when I was in Ghana, the slave castles, and got to work on some really cool policy work for the country of Ghana and their power infrastructure stuff. And then I came back, and my last role in corporate America was building a $20 million division for a Fortune 550 company. And in that, I was employee number two, started on January 13th. And by Labor Day, we had 175 people on the team.
Wow.
And by here, we'd done $20 million in revenue and about 30% profit. My reward for that $6 million was getting to lay people off. And that message came to me on Christmas Eve. And it's like, you need to spend the next week figuring out who's still going to have a role in the new year. And I was like, I don't think this is right. I don't ever want to do this again. I said, well, you can let somebody else pick, but you've got to do this again. So you probably want to pick the people that you want on the team so that you can actually do this successfully. And so I did it. I promised myself I would never do it again. Fast forward to Thanksgiving of the next year, same thing. I said, I'm out. And so this is when I become the self-proclaimed corporate America dropout. And I decide to move back to real estate. And so, you know, there was a guy that lived downstairs in that apartment building that I was talking about that I moved out of pretty erratically, who we were doing the math, and that's what all engineering students do in their free time, right? And so I was paying $395. I had two roommates paying $395. He had the same thing going on downstairs. When we multiplied it out, the guy that owned the complex was making $700,000 a year. And so it was like, I want to do that because I don't have to make 700. Like, I can make 50 and I'm good. Like,
We call it mailbox money on this show.
Yeah.
We love mailbox money.
We love mailbox money.
Yeah, so I wanted to do that, right? But I didn't know how. I didn't have access. You know, I'm the son of a soldier and a stay-at-home mom. So we went, just started getting some credit, getting some money in the bank, getting some experience, and said, we'll figure it out later. And so I went back to that. I was like, okay, I got a deal. I went to the banks, went to 10 of them. They all told me no. You guys just.
And what asset class were you looking into, Jerome?
We were doing C. So C in a B area was this.
In multifamily residential?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they told me I didn't have the right experience. I was like, well, I just did this and, you know, I got an MBA. I got a professional engineering license. I got my project management professional certificate. Like, what do you want? They're like, we want you to do this business plan on a project of similar size before. I was like, you're right. I don't have that experience. And they said, well, go find a partner. I didn't know anybody, right? And I didn't know about all of the virtual networking. Well, we didn't have the virtual networking.
Not back then, no.
I didn't know about I didn't know that you could go pay people 20 or 30 grand to get in their course in order to buy an apartment, be told how to syndicate an apartment. I just knew that I wanted to go buy this thing. And so, you know, fast forward it. And today, you know, we've done five transactions. We we're running what we consider to be a meaningful business and looking to scale. The goal by 2028 is to have 1,000 doors and to help 100 people get out of their day job by teaching them how to invest and giving them opportunities to go be their own operators if they want to.
Okay, let's rewind a little bit, because we got where you didn't have an experience and the bank was telling you no. And one of the things, we have a lot of folks that listen to our podcast that want to get into real estate, and you know, you're definitely a motivational model for them. So how did you get from point A to your first deal? We'd love to hear that story.
Yeah, so I think so what happened was, after 10 banks told me no, I started fixing and flipping houses. Okay. And I'm on the stoop of one of my projects, and a guy pulls up and he says, "Hey man, let me check out your finishes." Like, okay. And so he walks through, he's like, "Yeah, we're doing one down the street, blah, 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 blah." He's like, "Oh, I like that. You took a wall out. Okay, okay, okay." And then he said, "Hey, do you know anything about that building downtown in Churchill?" I was like, "Yeah, I tried to buy that 4 or 5 months ago, but they told me no." He said, "Well, I'm getting ready to make an offer on it." I was like, "Oh, you're the guy I've been looking for. So I need somebody with experience, and we should partner on the deal." He's like, "What are you going to bring to the table?" I said, "I don't know. We'll figure it out. But I want to be in the deal with you because you're the guy I've been looking for." And sure enough, he went and made the offer without me, right? Because he didn't need me. And yeah. Tell him I was bringing $100,000 or $200,000, so it didn't matter. Eventually, he goes and talks to one of the guys that I talked to about doing the deal back in January, maybe even December of the previous year. And he said, "Oh, that's the one Jerome was talking about. I'm only doing the deal if Jerome does the deal." He needed a guy to be the general contractor because he had his license. And so fast forward, I get to be the asset manager for that project. And since we bought from one of the big brokerage houses, they did a press release.
Excellent.
It was in the paper in the press release. Little old me. And guess who called me based on the press release?
The guy who made the offer.
No, the banks.
The bank, even better.
Calling me, and they wanted to know if I'd already lined up refinance money for the deal, if I had anything else in the pipeline, right? Because now I got a pipeline because I did one deal and all of the things. And the reality of the situation is I didn't know any more before that article was written than I did before, but I signed a loan, and that was what the bank needed to justify giving me $1 million to go do a deal. And so we leveraged those relationships. We left Richmond, Virginia, came to Greensboro, North Carolina, and we've been buying here, and we really want to be the market maker in this city. You know, we've got 120 unit development that we're working on.
Oh, wow.
Going on that we've already purchased and repositioned and getting near the end of that cycle for that business plan.
And so how do you, and if you can share a little bit of the secret sauce with us, what factors do you look at when you underwrite deals?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, for me, it's really simple, right? I'm looking for the solid location. And so what does that mean? I characterize it by the stores that are in the area. So I like Food Lions. I like Harris Teeters. Publix are kind of on the high end, but they may work. I like Walmarts. I like Targets. I don't like Dollar Generals, right? And so I'm looking for those types of stores in the areas that we buy. I like Chick-fil-A's a lot if I can get a Chick-fil-A close by. And so buying in those areas tell me that it's solid demographics. I look for places where market rent is at least $100 higher than, and you stack those things together, and I think you've got the recipe for a successful project.
You said you were teaching or helping people learn this. Where are these classes taking place?
So I do one-on-one coaching. And for those, you know, we connect and do virtual conversations. And so the fundamentals of apartment investing don't change. It doesn't matter what market you're in. So that's applicable everywhere. What is all the rage is syndication, right? Everybody wants to syndicate a deal. And I'm counterculture in that. I think people who haven't had any real estate investing experience, especially from a buy and hold standpoint, should spend their time getting tuna in the boat. That's what I call it. I call syndication hunting Moby Dick, right? You want to go take down this 150 unit deal, that's $6 million, and you want to do that with no money, no experience.
Yeah, we prepare the documents, the securities documents for a lot of our clients. And that's what everybody's saying now, especially since, 2012 under the Jobs Act, it's made it with, even easier with crowdfunding and under a 506C where you can use social media and things like that. Everybody is trying to hit a home run. A lot of our clients, they'll find one or two folks to kind of partner up with, like as a joint venture or something like that.
Yeah. And so that's my game, right? I'm a joint venture guy. And this is kind of you go get a smaller deal. And you don't have to do a smaller deal. It's just a function of capacity. So if you got enough money to fund the down payment and be liquid enough on the backside and you've got people with the net worth, you can do a $100 million deal as a JV. And I like that better because you've got vested interests. You've got the right people in the game who are really interested in making it happen. And, you start stacking all that stuff together and you can build a really beautiful relationship. I feel like, and I don't know that it's the nicest way to say it, but you have people just going along for the ride when you have limited partners in your deal. Mm-hmm. And for me, that isn't exciting. I want to share the spoils of war with the people who went to war with me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. One of the other things, I can just see it because we see it on the flip side of it. So we'll do a deal where there's, we our clients syndicate it. And I can just tell you from my client's experience, the limited partners will drive the sponsor crazy. And just think about it. If you have one or two people to please in a joint venture versus, let's say, you have 10 or 12 people and some people have invested as low as $10,000, can you imagine the aggravation? I can tell you that the people that invest the least amount of money are the ones that will drive you the craziest. Yeah. I'm sure you can agree with
us on that. They have the most questions and the most concerns and
So, and that's a small part of it. The other thing that I think we miss is like those people probably shouldn't be investing in the deal, guys.
Exactly.
And it's okay. Like the educators have messed it up for us. You think about the cash flow quadrant, right? Mm-hmm. Employee, small business owner, or self-employed business owner and investor. Everybody's rushing to that I. When they should be rushing to the business owner, because that equity, that's where you build your true wealth. And that's where you get the money to invest. But no, you got 10 grand. Oh, I've got more money than I've ever had. Yeah. Go double or triple that money in your business and then put it into something. But no, oh, I got 10,000. So now I'm gonna put it in. They offer me a 6% return. I think that's a few hundred dollars a year. And so you don't start seeing a compounding, but if you can put it together, you can put it together. And that is pretty tough for people who are trying to get into the space. And I know everybody's trying to build wealth, but I just feel like there are more ways to do it quicker. And so back to this joint venture versus syndication thing, like I wanted to be a fighter jet pilot. That was one of the many careers that I wanted as a child. The other one was a garbage man, by the way. And I see joint ventures as being fighter pilot operators, right? Everybody's got a job, everybody's involved, whereas the syndications are jumbo jets, right? You set the business plan before you go in and you tell people what type of returns they're going to get and you don't deviate from either one of those. Whereas you can be nimble with a joint venture and you can attack and adjust. And I think the people that are like operators right now in this kind of uncertain environment are really enjoying being able to get on a call with their partners and say, hey, here's what's going on. What do you guys think? And have an intelligent discussion about what are the next best steps for not only the business, but for the residents, right? Because it's not just selling widgets. Like you have somebody's home that you're responsible for at the high level. And you need to make sure that at the end of the day, you can look yourself in the eye and say, hey, I did the right thing by these people.
So along those lines, during COVID, we've had a lot of other, operators on and being one of the areas that we press a lot of, and we mentioned to you earlier, is we do a lot of bankruptcy and foreclosure. So we probably get 10 or 15 calls a day from tenants in the process of being evicted. And so we're just curious, what steps have you taken to work with your tenants during this uncertain time?
Yeah. So It's been pretty simple for us. Are you impacted by COVID or not? Right? Did you lose your job? Did you get sick? Whatever it is. Okay, prove it. Show us the pink slip, show us whatever. All right. Have you filed for whatever support that the government's going to give you? Did you file your tax return so that they can send you your stimulus check? Did you file for unemployment so that you can get your unemployment benefits? Because the majority of our stuff is under $700 a month. So that stimulus check and those unemployment benefits allow them to still do what they needed to do. Okay, you did all those things. Great. So you have the money to pay your rent. And while it might not be comfortable, you can still take care of your obligations. Great. All right. Now for this people who don't have the things that they need, let's work out a payment plan because, I mean, it still costs money for you to be here and you can't really expect us to absorb all that, right? So what's your payment plan? What can you actually do? What are your plans for getting back to work if you need to get back to work? And now we just hold you accountable to the plan that you agreed to. And we just keep going through that. As long as people are making progress and doing what they say they're going to do, they have a place to live. The moment that they ghost us and stop communicating and stop doing the things that we want or need done, then they've breached our contract and we need to part ways so that we can work with somebody who absolutely wants to live in a place where they're going to get their maintenance requests taken care of. The owners actually care about the property and what's happening and not just trying to siphon off all the money that they can and so on down the road or the list. Because, you know, part of our mission is to make sure that we erase the cognitive dissonance that sometimes happens between owners and residents, or they would call them tenants, right? Where it's like, well, I can't really see myself in you. I can't see the humanity in you. So I can let you live any kind of way because I don't care. We don't think that way. Our investments have to make an impact.
That's great. And do you a lot of, because we had spoken to someone before, he had 800 apartments. He said he actually didn't have many people not paying rent. Do you find that people are being a little bit more responsible and stand-up-ish just because you're giving them this option, which, by the way, and Stephen would agree with me, there's not a lot of landlords that are discussing with their tenants like options or payment plan options. They are just calling us and telling us, we want them out. That's it. I don't care.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's in poor taste, right? And bad on me for throwing stones. But there's some people who try to take advantage of the system, right? Mm-hmm. There's one person in particular that I'm thinking about because he comes up every week in our weekly report. And, you know, he signed a new lease in February. He didn't pay in February. We were going to evict him in March. And he wasn't impacted by COVID, right? But he knew that he couldn't be evicted. So he wrote it out. And so he didn't pay rent for 6 months. And so we finally got him evicted in the last window. And we're doing a lockout like this week or whatever. And there are those people that do that stuff, right? But that's not the majority of the folks.
Yeah, we're in South Florida, so we have a lot of folks that are gaming the system. It's South Florida is known for folks that game the system.
Yeah. And with that said, but there's a ton of people who aren't gaming the system and they realize, because here's the thing, like you still have the balance, right? Like you cannot pay, but you still have that balance. And depending on who files for eviction and how they file for eviction, you probably going to end up with the judgment on your record if you're not careful. Mm-hmm. So that money is still owed. And this whole idea of, well, yeah, it doesn't matter. And when you add on, hey, you're going to get evicted too. Like all those things really make your life harder going forward, kind of going back to the getting in trouble and not doing what you're supposed to do thing, Selena, right? They're setting themselves up for a lot of heartache. And there's not a way to make that stuff go away easily.
Exactly. So we're going to shift focus a little bit now, and we've talked a lot about business. Now we're going to tone it down a little bit and talk a little bit about fun and pop culture, and then we'll end with our lightning round. Selena, you have a question for Jerome?
Well, I want to know what's going on with the Matrix in the background.
Yeah, that was, you stole my question.
Okay. I don't know if I should call you Neo or what's going on.
So I was Neo at one point, and now I prefer to be Morpheus, right? I like to give people the opportunity to choose the red pill because I think it's a much more comfortable place to be once you get used to being uncomfortable. And so the red pill is about choosing to live in truth. And the truth is yours, right? I think a lot of us are programmed when we're young so that we're easily controlled. And then as we grow, we rebel, but we don't ever actually do the work to find out what we really believe. And so a perfect example of this is when somebody sneezes, a courteous person will do what?
Say, bless God you. Bless you and get a tissue for somebody.
Right. Bless you.
Right.
Are you blessing me? Because I sneezed. Like, there is no scientific reason for it. My heart didn't stop, if that's what some of the folks.
No, but you're not blessing them. You're saying God, the term is God bless you. May God bless you. Not I'm blessing you. Huh?
For what?
Oh, continued health. You know, may God bless you, that's not something worse.
But you don't bless me. You don't say God bless me when I have hiccups. You don't say when I cough. Like, it's just kind of one of those things. And we're doing them just out of programming, not because it has some true meaning. And so that's kind of the point. It's just like you sit down and you say grace when you're getting ready to eat fried chicken and Coca-Cola. Like, none of those things are good for your health. But
no.
So we have these habits. And so it's really, for me, it's about unplugging and then asking, what do I truly believe and why do I believe it? And then, does this serve my life? Does this serve where I want to be and where I want to go? Because at any moment, you can redecide or redefine who you are and then go on that path. But it's all about your belief system. And so for me, the red pill signifies saying, I'm going to go down that path. And when I'm down that path, I will make the new framework for the way that I view life and what I make my decisions on. Because the decisions make habits and habits make your life.
Excellent. Excellent. So one of the other things about you that I'd like our listeners to know is that you host two podcasts, and we'd love to know a little bit about that. But I guess my first question is more to Celine and I, what advice would you have for us as newly minted podcast hosts?
I think that asking amazing questions and being selfish with the podcast interview is the best way to use it, right? When you have folks come on, sometimes you're going to get folks on that you can't get on the phone to have a conversation with you regularly. But if you tell them you're going to record it and share it with the world, they'll sign up for that. And so for me, I take the opportunity to get one-on-one mentoring sessions, right? And we have a conversation where you get into all of the questions. And like, you guys on this podcast have stories that I haven't told anywhere else, right? And because you ask questions that led us down the path where we could actually dig into some of that stuff. And so I think you're doing the absolute right things, but I'm telling you to be selfish because you're not so different from all the other folks that are out there and the people that are going to be attracted to your podcast. They're interested and curious about the same things. And so by you asking the questions, you'll get the answers that will not only feed your soul, but those of the listeners who will listen on a weekly basis.
I think we're funny too, but maybe some people disagree with that.
I enjoy your humor.
Okay, so tell us. I know you have two podcasts. You have Dreamcatchers and you have Multifamily Missteps. Could you tell us a little bit about both of those and tell us how our listeners can listen to those as well? Because I don't mind sharing our listeners with you, Jerome.
And tell us how they can get with you one-on-one.
Yep.
Also, because I want to learn more, so I'm sure everyone else does.
Love it. So Dreamcatchers is my passion project. It tells the stories of people who've exited the matrix. And the whole goal is to leave the breadcrumbs for everybody else who's trying to get out, the tools, the tactics, the techniques that they use to make that transition. You don't have to leave your day job in order to exit the matrix, but maybe you become an entrepreneur where you're adding value within the business and making yourself a linchpin so that you get that job security, but you also get increased responsibility and that raises your income. But the goal there is simply to provide inspiration, education, and direction to the folks who check out the podcast and bring on folks who are doing things in a new and unique or different way. Many of them are contrarian and they like to challenge the status quo. And I feel like that's part of my role as Chief Inspiration Officer there. On Myers Methods Presents Multifamily Missteps, we talk to operators and we get the war stories. Every podcast that I was listening to, I used to listen to 40 hours of content every week, guys. It was everybody made money, nobody made mistakes, and you should come in with them. And I just know it wasn't true. And I wanted to go out and stop giving you the HGTV version of multifamily investing so
exactly.
that I sell you a course or sell you some mentorship. I want to tell you the stories where people make mistakes because that's where all the learning happens. And in doing that learning piece, we are becoming a better community of operators, right? There's no reason for me and Steve to make the same mistake or me and Selena to make the same mistake. We aren't competing with each other once the deal's closed, right? You've got operating your deal, the more you can get for rent, better for me because now I can raise my rent, right? And we can all grow together because a rising tide raises all the boats. We might be competing when we're trying to get a deal under contract, but those windows are so concise and so small that part, I don't really think it's worth discussing. And so I was trying to fill a void in the marketplace where we actually have a conversation about the reality of being an owner and an investor, right? If you're putting your $10,000 in, expecting to start getting checks at the end of the first month, when you're in a value add project, you're probably in trouble. Right. And so I just want people to get the full story because I hate when, and it happened this morning, somebody said, hey, I picked the wrong education company. It cost me tens of thousands of dollars. And now I'm really selective about who I work with, et cetera, because I don't want to get sold a blank bill of goods. I agree with them wholeheartedly. And I really wish that never happened to them. But usually what happens is because they're more established and it's sexier. The folks who are being marketed to, they're getting brought in and then they write those five figure checks. I call it buying a used Mercedes or BMW. And then they realize that they got something and it wasn't what they actually wanted. And so then they come back to me and say, hey, can you help me get my first deal? And I personally don't believe that you have to buy, you know, $30,000 or $50,000 course to find out whether or not you want to do this business. I think you can find it out a whole lot quicker. And so that rolls us into, hey, so MyersMethods.com, MyersMethods.com will get your listeners a free four-step guide on to how to get into multifamily investing.
We love free gifts.
Yeah. Yeah. That will get them that free four-step guide. And then there's also a podcast. It's about 15 minutes of exclusive content. You can't find it anywhere else where we break down why we like joint ventures over syndications. And that, for me, that's super important. For people who actually want to be active operators, there isn't anywhere else where anybody's sharing that message. And it's important for me because you can take all these lessons that you learn in a joint venture and move over to be a syndicator. But it's really difficult to go back the other way. And so what I really want to do is just say, hey, guys, let's go get some tuna in the boat, right? And then after you get some tuna in the boat and you get a bigger boat and maybe you go get a bigger boat, then you go well hunting, right? You got some track record, you got some reputation. Because, I mean, it baffles me. People call brokers and they're like, hey, I'm looking for 100 unit building in the Southeast, this value add with $100 NOI upside. And it's like, how are you going to do that?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm working with a group of people and we've got a track record of over 50 years. And like, what group of people? Like who's actually going to sign the loan to get this deal done?
You know how many calls a day we get for clients that want us to represent them and, oh, you'll get paid at closing. Don't worry.
No. If you've been in the game long enough, you know better than that. And there's a bunch of people running around who don't have the wherewithal to even write the due diligence check so that they can get the property under contract. And so I want you to, and so when you start digging in and say, hey, I don't actually have any experience, right? And then move that out a little bit. And it's like, oh, well, it doesn't actually seem practical that I can actually close this deal. But if I can tell you, hey, Selena, I just closed on a 10 unit. We're executing the value add there. It's going well. We've been in it for about 6 months. I'm looking for our next deal. we found that things are working well in this market, and that was our test. We're looking to scale up. Do you have anything that's of similar vintage and property type so that we can execute the same bigger business plan on a larger scale? That's a compelling conversation that's actually traction. And so that's my game. I want to help people walk down that path, and they don't need me to do it, but I've made enough mistakes that I think I can keep them from driving off a bridge. And that's my whole thing. It's not about how much money I'm going to make you. It's about how much money I'm going to keep you from losing, and how much I can help you get, how much faster I can get to, you can get to the results that you're seeking.
That is the best way to put it, how you can prevent them from losing money. That's always my fear. I mean, I get into little projects here and there. Usually my partner is always my brother, you know, family, just because we're a family of entrepreneurs and always merge and work together. And it works for us. But I'm always scared to take that extra step because I'm like, I don't want to lose money.
Exactly. So we're gonna ask you one more each pop culture question, and Selena's gonna take us home with the lightning round. So my question, I'll let Selena ask her question next, and then take in the lightning round. My question, yeah, I love leveraging virtual networking. I think I don't want to meet anybody in person ever again the way things are going.
Yeah. So I don't have a great show. I if I had to pick something though, I think I would pick Lucifer. I think that show is cool.
That is cool.
Okay. Let me ask you, it's more of a political question, but I'm going to ask you anyways, just because you played sports, and what is your opinion right now with the NBA supporting BLM as a movement? I like to ask everyone what they think, because a lot of people, you know, we get mixed feelings. We get a lot of people saying, you know, sports players shouldn't be involved in politics. I am of a different opinion. I am too. Yeah, I'm just a completely from a different opinion, and I'm maybe, I don't know if it's just a younger generation thing, but I feel like if it relates to me, not just me, if it relates to the world, it relates to me. So how do you feel about that? Because I saw them playing and they're all wearing Black Lives Matter jerseys, and they're really making a statement.
Yeah, so at the risk of being ignorant, because I don't watch the news, so I didn't even know that was happening. With that said, like, I believe that the majority of the players in the NBA are of African descent, right? Especially the ones that are getting the bigger contracts. And so it's when you're a high income earner, when you're on TV, you have fame and celebrity, you waste it if you don't use it to move the society forward. And so I think
absolutely,
it's responsible for those folks to have that type of platform and then not use it to make the world a better place. At the end of the day, like, the whole Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter and all this stuff is just a bunch of division. If we could actually see everybody as humans, we could see the humanity in everybody, then a lot of these atrocities wouldn't happen.
Even attorneys, Jerome, because we are human too.
You guys are humans. But at the end of the day, like, at some point, we've got to figure out the humanity of it. And I really, to keep it in sports, but to move it to a different sport, like, Michael Vick was sentenced in a very irresponsible way from my perspective. When you look at some of the sentences that people get for killing humans versus what he got for killing dogs, right? And I don't even know how much of it was actually him killing dogs versus him just being affiliated with it and somebody wanting to make an example of him. With that said, I just want to make sure that we treat humans as humans. All humans should be treated the same because we're all one race, right? We're all the human race. And so I think it's absolutely imperative that if you have a platform, you use it to make sure that everybody sees the humanity, even if they haven't been exposed to maybe that group of people or people that look that way or a certain type of way.
At the detriment of their career. And I say that just because of what happened with Colin Kaepernick. I mean, he pretty much lost his career for taking a knee.
So I think Colin is a great example of people trying to make an example of someone. But with that said, I truly believe that you can't do things for money. You've got to do things because they're the right thing. And when you do things because of the right thing, everything works out in the end. And so, do you think we would be where we are had Colin not taken that stand then?
No, we wouldn't be.
I don't. I think he started a movement and he was a catalyst for something way bigger than than what was happening in that space. And while he may have lost some income, I don't think our impact as humans is only based on how much money we make. And so I think he made a statement that really lit the world on fire. And for me, that's exciting because he'll be rewarded for that in other ways in the future. And I don't think he's going to be on the street anytime soon from that standpoint, right? I mean, you can make but so much money. I mean, you can buy as many. I like Ferraris and Lamborghinis. I can buy those things, but is it really making the world a better place other than inspiring somebody else to make more money by solving a big problem so that they can buy one of those? I don't think so.
Thank you for not being afraid to answer
Right, we
that
have some
question.
guests that are afraid to answer these our hard-hitting questions. Okay, Selena, take us home with the lightning round.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you this or that questions, and they're going to be, just random. You just say what you prefer, okay? So it's going to be easy. It's just a little personality, so we know a little bit more about you, okay? So, coffee or tea?
Tea.
Huh. Okay, dogs or cats? Batman or Superman?
Batman.
Yeah, what is up with Batman?
Even Ben
Superman is
Affleck as
alien.
Batman, he was pretty bad as Batman.
Batman, I love the fact that it's the poverty to riches story
Oh,
and
yeah, okay.
caring about the riches and wanting to do good with the riches.
Okay.
Okay, good, good. Everyone has a different
I like
perspective,
it.
so I
That's
like
a
to
good
hear it.
reason.
Yeah. Cake or pie? Kanye or Jay-Z?
Jay, all day.
Beyonce or Rihanna?
Beyonce.
Really? Surprised. You've been to the Caribbean a lot.
Beyonce's Creole.
right. Well, that was it. That concludes my lightning round. See, it was easy. It wasn't anything crazy.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jerome. Please tell our listeners again how they can find you. Social media, websites. Tell us all.
Instagram.
Tell us how we can download your two great podcasts.
Yeah.
Instagram, Facebook,
Yeah, I don't
your
want
mailing address, or
to. Google Earth of your home.
I don't want to confuse people. So if you want the podcast, you can just type the Myers Methods present, or you can type in multifamily missteps or dream catchers on the same platform you're using to listen to this. If you want to learn more about multifamily investing and our approach, hit myersmethods.com. And if you want to connect with me on social media, I'm on LinkedIn every day. So Jerome Myers, Greensboro, North Carolina.
Well, thank you so much, Jerome. This was truly a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
This was
We
awesome.
learned a lot.
I appreciate you guys.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Attorneys Are Human Too. Please subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast host. Please also leave us a five-star review with your podcast provider. Hope you enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to seeing you next time.